oftentimes now I get people who come to me who watch my channel and are really feeling uncertain and just confused, grew up in one tradition, and now they're wondering if they're in the wrong one and they're not sure what to do about it.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
You are listening to Premier Christian Radio, and this is The Profile. It's our weekly long-form interview with a Christian who has something interesting to share. I'm Tony Wilson, and I write for the partner magazine of this show, Premier Christianity. The magazine comes out monthly online and on real paper too, and we can deliver it to your door. If you take a look at premierchristianity.com, you're likely to dig up some subscription offers, and you can also read the online news feed and the comments that go up there. Right, well, this week on The Profile, it's a great pleasure to be sitting down with the podcaster and YouTuber Austin Suggs. He grew up in the United States in a Christian family, and following a period of intellectual doubts, he came back to faith and studied theology at the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. For a while, Austin spent time crafting YouTube and podcast material, but the only problem being that nobody was paying any attention. But one of his videos suddenly took off and propelled his channel into new territory. Now the host of Gospel Simplicity, Austin interviews many high-profile Christian leaders and academics, such as John Mark Comer and Gavin Otland, for example. And some of his videos receive over 300,000 views. He and his wife live in Baltimore and worship at a non-denominational church. Austin, I've been a great admirer of your work for some time, and it's a great pleasure to be talking with you on The Profile today.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks, Tony.
Well, in a moment, we're going to do a bit of a spiritual biography. First of all, I'd like to take a moment, give a bit of a trailer, and ask you, could you give a sort of 60-second elevator pitch for Gospel Simplicity?
Sure, I'll do my best here. So I like to think of Gospel Simplicity as a place where I try to bring simplicity out of theological and historical complexity. So as someone who's fascinated with church history, I have been diving into it myself and found that it's really complicated. So I try to find the smartest people I can to help make sense of it and find beauty, truth, and goodness in the Christian tradition.
That's a very good summary. So thank you very much for being so concise. We're going to pick up on that theme, obviously, later. But let's go right back and find out about your formation, how it is you came to be the person you are today, and particularly your faith biography. So tell us a little bit about growing up, where you did, your family life, church life as you were growing up.
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in a non-denominational church, a fairly big one for the context that I grew up in, about 2,000 people a week there. And my mom was on staff. So church was a big part of our life, whether that was just on Sundays, right? Being there for all the services all day, or also during the week at worship rehearsals and various things like that. So church was kind of central to our life, and I loved it. A lot of people, you know, they grew up around church and they kind of overdose on church, if you will, and want nothing to do with it. But that really wasn't me. I loved church. And from a young age, I was just fascinated with God. I remember when I was really little, my sister was running around the house singing Britney Spears, and I was running around the house like making up worship songs at like 4 years old. And my parents had just started going to church and were like, have we joined a cult? What is our kid doing? But it all turned out okay. And yeah, so faith was really important to me. But then I would say around high school, you mentioned I went through a period of intellectual doubt, and that's kind of when that comes in. Kind of a perfect storm of things happened for me that caused me to begin to second guess my faith. That was all in a couple month period. My mom was diagnosed with breast cancer. My sister, who had been dealing with chronic illness for a long time, lost her ability to walk due to some neurological conditions that kept her from being able to balance. And then also at that time, the pastor of the church I grew up in, I got to see behind the curtain a little bit and found out that he just really wasn't the person I had put up on a pedestal, and saw a lot of deep dysfunction within the church and realized that I was just not sure I wanted anything to do with it, and began to wonder, not necessarily questions of like, does God exist at first, but really started with, I don't think I like God anymore, and I certainly don't like his church. So the question of whether he exists doesn't seem all that consequential to me if I don't want much to do with him. And so that's kind of when that period of intellectual doubt came in. But that's kind of my early years. And then
I'm interested in that because you're a teenager at this point, and of course it's a difficult time as you're trying to position yourself in a world. You've got a lot of academic stuff going on. You've got a lot of stuff going on with friends and family, and that's hard enough to process. And at that stage of our lives, we haven't really developed a very sophisticated theology which would take us through the kind of events that you're describing. So two big family health issues and a church issue that you're struggling to deal with. So we can hardly blame the teenage Austin for struggling to process all of that. So it took you outside church. Did you kind of quiet quit, in to use the modern term of sort of going along but not taking part? How did that work?
That's a really good way of putting it. I've never put that terminology to it, but I think I'll have to use that as I reflect on it in the future. Yeah, that's really what happened. So there's no like grand dust up with my parents or anything where I say like, I want nothing to do with this anymore. I'm not going to church. And I should say that they're both really wonderful. I often say if I can end up, you know, with a marriage half as good as theirs and, you know, just following in their footsteps, I'll have done more than enough with my life. But yeah, I just kind of began to check out of it, to be honest. You know, I would still go to church, but didn't really care much for it. And I think what I found was that I pulled away from any of my personal engagement with it. So often growing up, I would be someone who would be reading scripture or just engaged in prayer, and kind of your, you know, personal devotional life was always a big part for me. And then I just let those things fall off and would still go to church, but wasn't in any way kind of personally invested in it.
Mm-hmm. And so that has a tendency for our faith to go a bit cold and become quite dysfunctional, really. So were you actually actively deconstructing your beliefs? Because deconstruction has been a big thing for particularly for Gen Z, I guess. There's been quite a big movement towards deconstruction, and we'll unpack that a little bit in a moment. But was that something you were doing, or would that be to put too grand a title on it?
It definitely moved into that. So I mentioned that at first I didn't really care whether God existed. I just knew I didn't particularly like him. It so happened, though, at that time, so that all kind of happened over a summer. And then going into that next school year, I got very close with one of my teachers. He was our English teacher, and I've always loved literature, loved reading, and he really took me under his wing. But he happened to be very into the New Atheists. And so he got me into figures like Christopher Hitchens. I remember him sending me videos of him. And at first, I'd say, you know, I kind of like laughed along politely, and then realized that I felt like his critiques were hitting home, and felt like that was part of how I was feeling, and took some of that on. So it definitely did move into that more formal deconstruction of, I don't know about any of these beliefs. And I suppose, though I was a little late to the party, I got some of the influence of the New Atheists, who get talked about a lot these days, it seems.
Mm. And did the intellectual weight of their arguments hit home? Did you find yourself adopting those? Did you get to the point where you would have called yourself an atheist?
Yeah, I think I always go back when I think about this to a specific period where it was between the junior and senior year of high school. And up until that point, a big part of my faith had been going on missions trips. And I'd been on like 7 or 8 of them at this point through the church. And I decided I didn't want to go through the church anymore, which is kind of a picture of where I was at. But I still wanted to do good things in the world. At that point, I was thinking about going into medicine and Doctors Without Borders. And so I was going on this kind of secular volunteer trip to teach English in Peru. And the reason this is significant to me is it was one of the first times I was around a group of people that didn't know me as the kid who went to church. Because even after I left private school, which wasn't related to this, and was going to public school, everyone still knew that faith was a big thing for me. I had led some Christian groups at the school and whatnot, and people, you know, associated me with faith. But all of a sudden, I was around people who knew nothing of my background. I remember we're sitting up late one night and just kind of casually talking with this group of volunteers, and people asked me, you know, are you religious? Like, you know, is that a part of your life? And for the first time, I looked at myself and just said, you know, I don't think so. I don't think that's true for me. And I remember saying it and being surprised, like, wow, how far have I come? Am I an atheist now? I didn't throw the term around a lot. And I guess if I would interrogate my beliefs now, going back to that like 17-year-old Austin, I suppose agnostic would probably be a better phrase for it, because although I had gotten into the new atheists, I do think the driving force was still that I don't particularly like God, and so I don't particularly care, you know. But it does seem once I started going down that path, the idea that God didn't exist became, one, less scary because I didn't particularly want him to. And two, it seemed like, yeah, maybe that's possible. So I wasn't, you know, someone that was going out arguing against belief in God, but for me, it was something that I wasn't really taking on board anymore.
And you've mentioned several times you didn't really like God. What was it about God that you didn't particularly like? You know, what if you were to try and articulate what it was that you were finding so objectionable?
Yeah, I think it was kind of like a ground up movement from that. So starting with kind of the representatives of God, if you will, I was finding a lot objectionable in Christians, specifically some of the Christian leaders I was seeing who were kind of using spiritual authority as a mask to just not be very nice people, and who were kind of claiming that they had, you know, authority from God, therefore they could treat people really poorly because it was all in the name of this bigger mission, and that everyone was kind of expendable as long as we were moving the gospel forward. And that was kind of the culture that was in this church that was growing a lot, but had a really kind of toxic staff culture. And I often said, you know, it was a church that grew on the backs of graveyards of countless volunteers and staff members who just kind of got chewed up in this machine of church growth. And so then I think I kind of moved that up into looking into the character of God and seeing someone there who I didn't particularly relate to, especially at this point, which will come into play as I move into faith. The God of, you know, it was almost like a, not to use overly theological terms, but like this Marcionite God, right? Where the God of the Old Testament's really bad and different than Jesus. And so I found myself kind of maybe looking back at old Bible stories that I grew up with. I remember specifically walking through church one day and there's this nice picture of Noah's Ark and thinking, this is a terrible story. Like, this isn't a good story. That I don't like this. And the God who drowns all of these people and saves a couple animals and a guy's family. Like, I began looking at that with new eyes, kind of along the way that a lot of, you know, atheists will, in very kind of emotional rhetoric. But finding, I don't think these stories that I grew up with are all that positive. Things like that.
And I alluded to the fact that you're far from being alone, because amongst your peer group and perhaps a few folk a little bit older than you, particularly I've noticed people who are Christian musicians, artists, and with a greater artistic sensibility, seem to have gone through something a little bit like this, and they've ended up in different places. So some have deconstructed and ended up kind of out of the church completely. Some reconstruct their faith back into, say, Eastern Orthodoxy or Catholicism, something which is quite distinctive from the tradition that they've come from. And do you have any sense of what's driving that?
Yeah, you know, I'd be hesitant to say that I can speak into any particular story, but in kind of broad brushes here, and hopefully it'll capture some, and I think it captures me, I would say that if we look at the formation of faith, especially in the tradition, I'm using air quotes for people that can't see my fingers there, that I grew up in, which it was, of course, very traditionless, but in kind of the seeker-sensitive, non-denominational church movement, a lot of your formation is based on emotion. It's based on these kind of big worship songs that make you feel a certain way when the smoke is going and the lights are dim and the band kind of rises up. And that's where, for a lot of people, I've heard people talk about like the sacrament of emotion, and non-denominational churches. And I think that comes back to bite people on the other hand, because as we talked about, a lot of these objections are kind of emotional objections. And I don't want to say that as like a negative thing. Our emotions are a very kind of immediate way we experience the world, right? And it's a very large part of our human experience, but it's not the only part. But so I think when we begin to hear these emotional arguments against faith, if our faith was built on emotion, it can also be undermined via emotion. And despite kind of growing up in church and even going to Christian school until I was about 12, I don't think I had any type of like deep formation or catechesis, to use an old word there, of really formal training in the faith where I had a theology that could withstand some of these things. I just knew I liked God. And when I started to not like God, well, there went my faith. And so I think that's probably true for some other people as well.
So what brought you back and why did you end up going to Moody?
I remember distinctly having this thought that I was running away from something, and that being the church and kind of the experience of God that I'd had up to that point. I knew that I was moving away from that. But I remember asking myself, like, what am I running toward? And I think these, while they sound like these kind of big philosophical questions, they're very natural questions to be asking when you're 17, 18, because everyone's asking you what you want to do with the rest of your life. At least here in the US, you know, you're applying for college, all your school counselors are like, what do you want to do? What do you want to major in? What are you going to do? Like, what are you going to do for a living? All of these things. And so it is a time in your life when you're asking kind of big questions in a comical way, because who knows what they want to do at 17. I applaud anyone who does. But so I have this thought of what am I running toward, and really felt like I wasn't running toward anything in particular. And so I began kind of looking back at why I'm running away from these things. And I, for whatever reason, took another look at just the figure of Jesus, who was just that for me at this point, like just a figure. What I'm running away from looks nothing like the Jesus of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Like this figure I like. And actually, I think it's this figure that I'm kind of measuring everyone else against and thinking, why don't you look more like that? And then there's a mentor in my life that is actually at that same church who I began meeting with, who had a really interesting story in that he didn't grow up in the faith, grew up kind of staunchly atheist, and then came into the faith while he was a Navy SEAL, and just a fascinating guy. But he gave me space to ask a lot of questions. And then for about a year, him and I would meet once a week, and we would just go on a hike. There's some beautiful hiking trails near where we lived. And we would just talk about theology, but from the perspective of natural theology. So no Bible was involved, and even really no text. This was just philosophizing, starting with questions like, why does anything exist? And he did a wonderful job of never giving the answer, but just talking through these things with me and helping me arrive at things. And so with these two things, I was able to marry, I find Jesus compelling, with actually an idea of a God that looks strikingly similar to what we find in scripture makes sense. And putting those two things together, I think I was able to, maybe for the first time, have this combination of affection, right, towards this figure of Jesus, but also a satisfying intellectual sense of this makes sense that God would create in this way. It helps me understand evil. And it allows me to say that the Christian faith is reasonable. And I can't love Jesus and hate the church. Now, I might have qualms with particular churches and the things being done in them, fair enough. But realized, okay, it seems like Jesus is into this idea of church. It seems like this is a central part of God's plan for redeeming the world, which is what it seems like he's up to in his plan. And so I should try to be a part of it. I end up interning at a church. And then it's during that period that I like to say they made the mistake of letting me teach in their high school ministry. And I remember having given my first kind of sermon, if you will, in that group, coming away from it and feeling like, wow, I found the thing I want to do. And also, wow, this is really scary because I'm finally realizing how little I know. I need to fill in those gaps. And that's when I came across Moody, and it seemed like a place where I could start to fill in some of those gaps.
Clearly a very renowned university for biblical studies, for theology. You engage in a BA, and at the same time you start a YouTube ministry and podcasting. you're sort of broadcasting to very few people. Would that be fair to say?
That is absolutely accurate. Yeah. And some of the way it started was actually that experience of going out and teaching, right? And I sat down with a different mentor of mine who's a pastor, actually the pastor at the church my wife and I attend now. I asked him, you know, what can I do to get better at this? And he told me in very kind of American sports parlance, just get more at bats, meaning like just get more practice. And I said, okay, but I was only going to be able to teach about once a month there. And I said, well, you know, I've got a camera. I can just sit down and practice speaking and try to get better at this. And yeah, that's how it started. And I think it was my mom, my grandma, and various YouTube bots that watched the videos for probably the first like year and a half of making videos more than once a week. So I've got a whole content library still up on my channel of videos that no one watched, but allowed me to get practice and think through big ideas, which was probably a blessing in disguise that not, you know, thousands of people were watching my first stumbling attempts at trying to make content.
And they're still available for people to watch. You've left them on there.
They are. Oh, yeah.
That's a mark of humility. So principally, you were doing that to improve your own performance in teaching, really. You weren't that worried about the fact that you weren't getting a big number of hits.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was just a challenge to myself. I said, I'm going to practice this once a week, and this is going to allow me to become a better communicator, to work through scripture. I was doing like Bible study videos and things of that sort, and really just keep getting reps in and keep practicing and hopefully get better at it.
What then propelled your channel into a greater audience? You know, where do you suddenly find yourself preaching to a receptive group of people?
Yeah, so the video that really took off was a video I made reflecting on going to a Catholic Bible study, which had happened years prior. So actually, when I was interning at this church, I got a call from my uncle, who had always been a big part of my life and was one of the kind of primary figures in my life who weren't Christians. And so I'd, you know, as a kid, always been praying for him in that. And I get a call from him one day of, hey, do you want to go to a Bible study? And I immediately say yes. And then he informs me it's at 5:30 in the morning at a Catholic church. And I think, wow, I should really listen before I talk, because what am I signing up for at this point? But anyway, I do it, and it's a great experience. You know, do it for about a year. And now it's several years later that I'm just sitting down and I think, I've got to make a video today, because I was very like structured. I have to do it, just, you know, whether I feel inspired to do it or not, I've got to do it. So I was like, what should I talk about? And I was like, well, you know, going to that Catholic Bible study was a really good experience. And maybe, you know, if someone watches this, they can have a thought that I had of, wow, you know, maybe Catholics aren't what I thought, because the only Catholics I knew growing up were people who kind of went through confirmation to get some presents from family and went to church on Christmas and Easter. That was just my experience of Catholicism, despite growing up in the state named for the Blessed Virgin Mary for English Catholics in Maryland. Anyway, so I make this video and basically say, hey, I went to this Catholic Bible study. Turns out Catholics read the Bible. Who knew? I know. It's amazing. And, you know, push record, hit it out there, and expect, like usual, 10 people to watch it or so. And all of a sudden, the video's getting, you know, 1,000 views, and then 10,000 views, and then 50,000 views. And even kind of more amazing than that, to me, was all of a sudden my comment section was flooded with these really intelligent Catholics who are asking me questions that I have no idea the answer to. Like, I had never come across Catholic apologetics. Again, what was astounding to me at this point was just the fact that there were Catholics who read the Bible, much less that they had very good arguments for being Catholic instead of being Protestant or something else. And so here I am, kind of first year Bible college student. All of a sudden, this audience of Catholics are now watching my videos, and I don't know what to do because they're asking me smart questions. And I think I should follow this up with trying to find the answers. Also, one of the most common comments that I got was, hey, it's cool that you went to this small group, this Bible study, but if you want to understand Catholicism, you should go to a mass. And so I do that, and I make a video about that, and that video gets even more views. And then it's a beautiful church, and they're like, can we see a tour of this church? And so I say, sure, kind of just keep following up in this way, make a church tour, which is to date still one of my most popular videos. And then there I am, the kind of evangelical Bible college student with an audience of really smart Catholics, and I've got to figure out what to do next.
Many evangelicals who went in would go into a church like the one you went into would find it full of objectionable things and would run for the door as quickly as possible. So what is it that encouraged you to press on into territory that was quite a way out of your comfort zone?
While I was at that church, they said, hey, you know, we're going to do a series on other denominations and other religions. Would you teach in this? And I thought, what do I know about this? And I said, okay, I'll do it. But, and I was working for that church full time at this point, kind of in a gap year between high school and college. I said, only if I can meet with a clergy member or something of this particular faith or denomination before you ask me to talk about it. Like, that doesn't seem fair to just do some internet research and talk about Eastern Orthodoxy then from there. So I ended up sitting down with a rabbi and with an Eastern Orthodox priest and with several other kind of religious leaders in the area. I ended up not teaching the series because I realized, who am I to talk about this? Like, guys, I can't do this. And instead talked about how we can have good conversations across these lines, which kind of foreshadowed where my channel ended up going. But so I think that natural disposition and having had the experience a little bit of sitting down with not only other denominations, but other religions to try to understand better helped prime me for this experience of going into a Catholic church and finding it just to be very different than I was used to.
Hi, I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity, the UK's leading Christian magazine. Every month, our team brings you deep, thoughtful journalism around the biggest topics affecting you as a Christian today. Our mission is to help you encounter God through the magazine. The latest issue features Switchfoot lead singer John Foreman, plus we're previewing the largest gathering of Christians ever. Find out more in the latest issue of Premier Christianity magazine.
At college, I was coming across the church fathers for the first time in some of my theology classes, and I was really latching on to them. I wouldn't say that the church fathers are like huge figures at Moody, but in certain kind of streams, especially among the theology students who might take more courses in that area, it is kind of one track that people get themselves onto it and find a lot. So as I make these videos at Moody, I end up having people come up to me who say like, hey, I saw this and I'm actually interested in similar things, but it's like this underground thing of people at Moody who are interested in Catholicism or Orthodoxy, which was an interesting little trajectory of my time there.
So coming onto your channel now, it sort of morphs into gospel simplicity as it's branded. A critic might argue on the grounds of trade description that actually you're not really very simple. So anybody who's watched some of your content would say, this is more like gospel obscurity. You know, it's kind of, I'm being taken into a level of debate discussion, which is quite academic very often. How do you answer the critic that says, right, the gospel is simple. It's believe Jesus, ask for forgiveness, get baptized and follow him. You know, that's the gospel and that's simple. And we don't need what you're doing.
Yeah, you know, I fully take that criticism. And on one level, the name of the channel is kind of a holdover from simpler times in my own life when that was all I was really talking about on my channel. And so on the one hand, I'd say, yeah, like the channel has gotten a lot more complex over the years. On the other hand, I would look at it in kind of two ways. So when I talked about the elevator pitch at the beginning, the word simplicity is kind of doing different work in the title now, rather than the gospel being simple. In some ways, it's trying to simplify very complex aspects of trappings that come along with the gospel. Because, you know, we can say that the gospel message is simple, but over time, it's taken on shape in different forms and institutions and throughout history that we just have to be honest are really complex sorting through these. Like why the East and the West have split over like half a word and the creed is complex, right? And so I can try to simplify those things. I would also say something that I've been kind of appreciating about that name more recently is trying to think that, you know, what keeps me sane amidst all of this? Because they can be kind of existential angst-inducing questions as you go through church history and these very various claims about who's in and who's out and what's the right church and all of this type of stuff. And I do think that the core gospel message is fairly simple, and that can be something of an anchor amidst this exploration into church history. And so oftentimes now I get people who come to me who watch my channel and are really feeling unmoored. They're feeling uncertain and just confused, and maybe in part because of some of the questions that I talk about on my channel. But they grew up in one tradition and now they're wondering if they're in the wrong one and they're not sure what to do about it. And so I think what the simplicity side of the gospel can do is say, hey, amidst all of this, you know, let's come back to what we do know about God. Where can we have kind of a firm hope in Christ and what he has done for us? And can that give us that assurance we need to then begin wading into these murkier waters or these more complex questions that might be unsettling at times, but amidst all of that, we can kind of come back to, okay, what do I know about God? What is fundamentally the gospel?
And looking at the guest list and engaging with the content as I have done over the last few years, you're drawing some of the big names, some of the big academics who are writing within the three great traditions of Protestantism, Catholicism, Eastern Orthodoxy. And inevitably, you are drawn into the gaps, the interesting little interstitial spaces between all of those, well, those three traditions. It feels like you're scratching an itch in the content. And would that be fair to say this is a big itch for you to scratch, that you're really fascinated by these gaps between these three great traditions?
I really am, which is lucky in a way, right? Because I stumbled into the type of content I make, and it would have been totally possible to have stumbled into something that I don't enjoy. And then you have to ask, do you keep making videos about something just because people are watching them? Or what do you do about that? But being a person of kind of insatiable curiosity, I find these things fascinating. I find the history of the church really stimulating, but also not just on an academic level, though I do find it very satisfying in that. But I've found a lot of just personal benefit of investigating these traditions, because in a lot of ways, I feel like I've been given new tools in the kind of toolkit of the spiritual life, whether that's kind of the prayer traditions of these different groups, or just kind of the way that they form people, has been personally enriching to take on board. But I do think that it can sometimes feel like a little bit of a puzzle to me, of you're searching through church history and these various groups are making claims. And it is really complex. And there's a reason that these divides kind of persist within the church. But there's, you know, 2000 years of really good thinking about why the church is set up in certain ways. And the kind of the stitches, if you will, between the traditions are where things are often rubbing into difficult theological questions, like what is the nature of the church? And on the one hand, you know, just as an example here, we can say that, well, the church is one, right? We have that in the Nicene Creed. And so the church is united, and Jesus prayed for the church to be united. And so it's like, okay, that makes sense. So there's one true church and it's undivided and that's all great. But what we've seen over the past kind of 100 years in the ecumenical movement is as we've gotten increasingly connected in the modern world, and we're not living in kind of silos where everyone belongs to the same tradition as us that we know, we look and say, wait, but that person really looks like a Christian and they're not in my church. But the Bible also says things like, you know, the church is the body of Christ, and that to be saved is to be united to Christ, to be in Christ. And so if that person's saved, they have to in some way be in the church, but they're not in my church. So do I either say they're not saved and because they're not in my church, or do I say that my church's boundaries are less clean and neat than I thought because, well, they are in the church and my church is the church, but they're not in my church. Like, you get to these really interesting things, and they're questions that mine's a lot smarter than mine, than myself have been contemplating. And so then you get to, yeah, just chase down these questions and try to figure out how to make sense of it.
But for you, you're content worshipping in a non-denominational church, sort of within mainstream evangelicalism. Nothing has persuaded you of the other traditions that they're worth jumping ship for, as it were. But if I were to push you on what would you say the single most attractive claim is of those three great traditions, Protestantism, Catholicism, and Eastern Orthodoxy, what over the course of the last few years of talking to really, really smart people has been the most compelling and attractive for each of those three great traditions?
Oh, I love this question. Yeah, so I'll kind of take them in turn. I'll start with the Catholic tradition. I think the idea of Catholicity being kind of the wholeness, the fullness, the universality there, right? Not the word Catholic can encompass a lot of different meanings. But what I find really compelling about the Catholic Church is both its kind of geographical Catholicity. So anywhere in the world, you can find a Catholic church. And there's great kind of quotes from like St. Cyril early in the tradition around the fourth century, where he's saying, you know, whenever you go to a new city, look for the Catholic church. And there's also the understanding that wherever you go, there will be a Catholic church, even at that time, to an extent in the known world that they knew, right? So there's the geographical Catholicity of it. I think the Catholic Church, better than these other traditions, has done a really tremendous job of trying to wrestle with these ecumenical questions. I mean, the thing I just outlined is essentially what the Catholic Church at Vatican II is working through in a document called Lumen Gentium, which is a great document. But so I think they've done a really good job of trying to see how can we bring these disparate churches together. And I think Catholicity, in terms of its theology, the Catholic Church, more than anyone, I would say, has really tried to hunt down every question. You know, the medieval scholastics, people like Thomas Aquinas, they get a bad reputation from some for asking questions like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. But they're asking these questions really because they want to know things, and they want to kind of seek out all of these answers, and they think a theology applies everywhere. And so there's just such a richness to the intellectual tradition, as well as, yeah, there's other forms of Catholicity. So I would say that for the Catholic Church. I would say for the Orthodox Church, what I find really beautiful, and I think anyone who's gone to an Orthodox Divine Liturgy will probably experience this, is this sense of kind of organic connection with the past, where you enter into it and it feels ancient, it feels otherworldly. And I think, you know, in a day and age where everything's being marketed to us, and, you know, all of our advertisements are customized to our own interests and our preferences, all our algorithms are to what I like. So if, you know, you're scrolling through Instagram, say, your entire feed might look different than mine, not just because of the people you know, but because of the businesses that want to sell things to you based on who you are versus what they want to sell to me. And I think the Orthodox Church really just goes in the other direction and says, we're going to give you something that isn't kind of like molded to you, but is just the way that we've passed it down. And it feels ancient and unchanging in that way. And I think has a real depth and beauty, and something that challenges you to adapt yourself to it, both in kind of the structure of the prayer life and those things. And so I'd say just generally the sense of continuity and the spiritual robustness of the Orthodox Church are all things that I think are really compelling there. In Protestantism, I find, I'll say a couple of things here. In that kind of spirit of inquiry, Protestantism, now we're painting with a broad brush here, right? Because that can encompass a lot of different things, right? You could have, you know, in my American context, like a very, say, liberal, if you will, Episcopalian church next to like a Southern Baptist church. And they're both Protestant, even though they don't share a lot in common, maybe methodologically, as they investigate things of theology. But I would say Protestantism is a very big umbrella. And it has given people the space to really inquire into these questions and not necessarily constrict them in the same way of, hey, if you kind of change denominations within Protestantism, or you change your view on this, you're outside of the church. The boundaries, though, in terms of individual denominations, might be stringent. In terms of Protestantism as an umbrella, as a movement, are quite broad. And so if you are someone who wants to investigate kind of at the edges of things, there's a lot of space to do that. I would say, you know, and that's a way in which people will talk about the Catholicity of Protestantism, that it can say, hey, the Catholics are saved, the Orthodox are saved, you know, the various Protestant denominations are saved. Again, this is a particular way of expressing Protestantism, that, you know, your mileage may vary in talking to people. But I do find that generosity of spirit to be a positive thing. I think also just the emphasis, and this is going to get more into like evangelicalism, on a personal relationship with Christ, this focus on knowing the scriptures, of getting in community, I think is a really big thing. And that kind of comes out of like the Wesleyan tradition, but this idea of studying the scriptures with a small group of people in homes, that's been a personally really enriching thing for me. And so I think those aspects of Protestantism are really beautiful in that it has you take ownership for your faith in a way that I think can be very enriching for people, and they can get a lot out of that. So maybe those are my not quite elevator pitches, but for the various traditions.
But yes, the three takeaways that you've developed over your course of your interviews. But in a way, couldn't we argue our way to some kind of hybrid denomination that takes seriously all of these elements and kind of build something that is a blended church? There's the so-called eucharismatic movement that's trying to do something along those lines, that's trying to take seriously that evangelical push towards intimacy and personal relationship and biblical understanding and knowledge, but equally takes account of the sacramental life of the church. Is that a project that's worth pursuing, or do you think it's a dead end?
I suppose it depends, the nature of it being a dead end or not, depends on what we see the destination being. And so if the destination is learning from each of these traditions and developing kind of a more robust form of worship and personal piety, I think it's absolutely fruitful. And I think it's being done within a lot of traditions, whether that's within kind of more evangelical churches adopting a higher view of the sacraments and of tradition and of liturgy to kind of give themselves a sense of foundation while also having the dynamacy of personal relationship and all of that. I think that's wonderful. And I think we're seeing that happen. Or if that's kind of coming from the other direction and you're already in a more sacramental high church tradition, but saying, yeah, we really do need this personal relationship, or even our interpersonal relationships. You know, we need to get to know one another in the church. We need to, foster a sense of community and inspire one another as we're going through our own lives of following Christ. I think absolutely these are very fruitful things, and I get a lot of encouragement when I see these things happening. And I think what happens is you pick up a lot of steam pretty fast, and then you hit some theological barriers, and you realize, oh, okay, there's a reason that even these organizations with a lot more funding, a lot smarter people, and a lot more resources haven't overcome these. And some of the divides that occurred at the Reformation, or the divides between the East and the West, they're there for a reason. And they butt up against fundamental kind of theological claims and ways of thinking of questions of like the essence of the church or salvation, even, that are really tricky to get over. And so, you know, I hope that we can get to greater unity, but I suspect we can have a greater unity in like charity and relationship at the ground level between people. At the institutional level of kind of bridging some of these gaps, I think it'll be difficult. But then again, as we move into like an increasingly kind of post-Christian context, I do think we will see almost out of necessity a greater working together. Just an example of that real quick in the United States is that there's now union essentially between the Lutheran Church and the Episcopal Church, where priests in those traditions can actually serve across those lines. And that's pretty much because of a lack of priests and out of necessity, really. It's like we're close enough together that we can, you know, maybe unity is a bit more possible there.
I sense that growth in charity across the different divide, a growth in a newfound respect for these traditions. And so I think you're right. And I think you're also probably right that full unity is probably an eschatological reality rather than something we can expect to see actually happen in human history. Talking of human history, I've just written something actually on Wolfe Hall for Premier, and the second season has just aired in the UK. I think it's coming to the US in the spring. I don't know if it's something you watched the first season of, but it came out about 10 years ago. It charts the bid to secure the succession of Henry VIII with fantastic actors, I have to say. Plays out across the early years of the Reformation, and it's quite easy to see how a lot of the the issues of the Reformation sort of and within Protestantism were baked in from the start. And it left me wondering, actually, we tend to look back on history, we tend to look back and we project our own beliefs back into history when we look at it, and our own confirmation bias that we bring to history. And so if we live in a largely Protestant country that sort of accepted the claims of the Reformation, we tend to sort of create a sense that, well, all Catholics were obviously traitors. You know, it was obvious that they should deserve to go to the to be executed. But if you live in a largely Catholic country, you take the opposite confirmation bias and you project that back into history. And you come away feeling, actually, it wasn't so much the truth claims of Protestantism that won the day. It was the fact that it kind of suited the powers that be, that enabled them to do what they needed to do at the time. Should we lament the Reformation, do you think?
Yeah, I think we should certainly lament the Reformation divides. I mean, I think if you look at the early reformers, and sometimes we can even split a reformer into like an early and a late figure, such as Martin Luther. You know, we have evolving ideas in these figures because the world is changing so fast at this point, right? But I think, generally speaking, you look at someone like Luther, he thought it was going to go a lot better than I think it did. And we have to remember Luther as like a Bible professor at this time, right? And so thinking, okay, I've realized there's some errors here, and I can kind of argue my way through this, and everyone's going to see the Bible the way I do. So if I just print it in German, all of a sudden everyone's going to read it just like I do, and it's going to be great. And he's kind of horrified by the end of his life that even Protestants, people like Huldrych Zwingli, are reading the Bible in the original languages even, and they're coming to different conclusions than him. And all of a sudden, he's realizing like, oh, this is a can of worms here, right? And there's these kind of intractable differences that are growing and multiplying. And I don't think he envisioned that at the beginning. I think that we can all just kind of reason together. We're going to work this out in his own kind of Luther way. He was a wily character, I suppose we could say. But yeah, you know, I think as like as someone who loves theology, I would love if the Reformation went back and instead of it being so kind of so intertwined with politics and power and nationalism and all of these different things that kind of get put in a boiling pot at the Reformation. You know, we like to think of it as though the Reformation was theology debates. And it was, but it was also theology debates that were wrapped up with what's expedient for the rulers of the day. What kind of, how does this work into the geopolitics of the late medieval, early modern period? And so, yeah, I think it would have been great if they all kind of sat down for a cup of coffee and talked through theology as if theology can ever be done in a vacuum. But it wasn't the way it is. And I think at the very least, something that I hope people get out of looking into the history of the church is a sense of lamenting that, man, the church, like, it is not meant to be divided. You know, we can all go back to John 17 and Christ's prayer there that his disciples may be one. And we look at the church today, and I think we're all forced in some way or another, even if it kind of works difficultly with our theology, to say the church is divided. Christians are divided, and it shouldn't be that way. And it's a scandal, and we should work toward unity, even if we are all working towards it in a way that is something that we won't realize in our own lifetimes. But you know, if we can each kind of move it closer, I think that's something we should be doing.
And I think giving a plug for gospel simplicity, you know, you talk about, well, if only we could have sat down over a cup of coffee. And that's exactly, I think, what you're achieving in gospel simplicity, is you are putting the kettle on and having a civilized conversation across these divisive issues. And, you know, if that had been an option way back in the 16th century, maybe we could have avoided some of the worst excesses of what took place in that time. Austin, I could speak with you for another hour if we had it, but we have to round off. And as I round off, I just want to ask you, there are very many people who are probably like you were a few years ago, wanting to break into the world of podcasting and YouTubing, and it's increasingly difficult in an increasingly crowded space. What advice would you give to somebody now trying to start a YouTube channel?
Yeah, great question. I think I could give advice on kind of like strategic or tactical levels. I'll try to blend a couple ideas here. One thing I say to everyone who asks me, and I get a lot of messages like, hey, I want to start a YouTube channel. What advice do you have? I tell everyone, essentially, don't do it unless you're willing to make 50 to 100 episodes that no one listens to. That was my own experience. And I think for a lot of people, that's going to be their experience. Is there ways to shortcut that? Absolutely. And if you already have an audience from somewhere else, if you can kind of get people to carry over, or if you're kind of part of a network like Premier Christian, you have opportunities to do these things. But I think generally speaking, I use this as a litmus test for people, because I think at times people want an audience, but maybe aren't really in love with making content. And if you're not going to just love doing it for 50 to 100 episodes that no one listens to, you're probably going to burn out. Even if it does get successful, if you don't just enjoy doing it, it's probably not going to work. And I think that's why I've continued to do it even when, you know, I'm doing grad school and working full time. I just love doing it. Even if it makes my life busier, it makes my life more full. So that's one thing I always say to people. I think, you know, on a more tactical level, I think one of the reasons, you know, my channel didn't succeed at first is because I didn't even really know what it was about. I was making videos about everything, like just generally Christian faith, right? And you have to kind of find that intersection of what you're interested in, what an audience, like an identifiable audience of people are interested in, and what do you have some competency in? And so if I was trying to like compete on my own great biblical insight at 18, that's just not going to work, right? There's plenty of people with PhDs who can do that. And so I tell people, sharing your experience trumps sharing expertise, especially when you don't have it. So I'm not an expert in these things, but I can share my experience investigating this. And I think also finding that audience, find like the smallest identifiable audience. You think, I want to reach all Christians, or I want to reach, you know, all people in the UK interested in politics, or all conservatives, or all liberals, or whatever, like these huge swaths, because we think, oh, it's really big, so I must be able to take a chunk. I would actually start the other way. I would say, what's the smallest group that you can become the best at? Like, be the big fish in a really small pond. And so if I'm looking at, you know, really like primarily young men, investigating the intersection of church claims between Protestants, Orthodox, and Catholics, and who are just trying to make sense of it. That sounds really, really small, but it's been big enough to reach lots of people. And that's not to say it won't reach young women or older men or older women or people who are just interested in one of these streams. That's all great. You'll catch those. But if you shoot at like a really small target and you try to essentially, you know, be the big fish in that small pond, I think you'll have more success that way. And you'll be able to think about, what is my audience interested in, and help bring the content that you have some experience or expertise in that you enjoy making. And you can kind of find that circle of the Venn diagram.
That's great advice. Thank you so much, Austin, for your time today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much, Tony.
You have been listening to me, Tony Wilson, on Premier Christian Radio. And this was The Profile, where I was in discussion with Austin Suggs. Join us again at the same time, same place next week, when we will bring you another guest.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.